Support for Art Talks comes from the Bucktown Center for the Arts at 225 East 2nd Street in downtown Davenport, with 16 independent studios and galleries offering original fine art and gift ideas in one location. Information is at bucktownarts.com. And from the Blue Cat Brew Pub, located in the district of Rock Island, serving food and handcrafted ales and lagers. And from Red Band Coffee Company, local roaster, offering individually prepared coffees, New Orleans-style iced coffee, and whole bean coffee at two locations in Davenport. Information is at redbandcoffee.com.
Well, hello and welcome. You've tuned into a conversation between artists. For the next hour, we'll be exploring the mind and the creativity of our guest. This is Art Talks, and I'm your host, Bruce Carter. Well, hello once again and welcome. Dana Wilkinson is with us. Dana is an interior designer of some note. She's been with Paragon Interiors. She was the founder and the owner of Paragon Commercial Interiors for over 30 years, 31 years. Her business partner is Darla Evans. Interior design, you're dealing with color, form, light, space, all those elements and patterns of art that are so essential. It's an art form equal to any other that I've ever known. Dana is also on the board of the Figge and has some interesting stories to talk about the construction and the making of the Figge. And she also has something to do with the interior of this radio station. And Dana, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bruce. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, I am too. I am too. We met at an opening of photographs of Hunt Harris. In that building, in that center, the Trimble Center in Rock Island. And Hunt mentioned, somebody mentioned that you had placed the pictures on the wall. And so we were talking about how the pictures were up, the black and white pictures were up, and how they were push and pull, and the volume of them, and how the you were leading the eye through a space. And I thought, wow, this is higher level stuff you're talking about here. And I said, have you ever been interviewed? And you said, well, once for the newspaper, but here you are here, and it's going to be a pleasure because you're so well qualified to talk about this. Anyway, welcome again.
Thank you very much.
How did it start for you? Where are you from? How did you come up?
Well, if you want to go that far back, I'm actually a native Iowan. I was born in a small town in northern Iowa and grew up basically in a farm town, really just enjoyed my childhood, my family. My dad was a banker. My mother was a teacher, but she was also an artist. Mm. And so I think that's probably where I really got my very first start. I remember part of the interest in interiors came about because I remember as a child we were building a new house. And my parents actually hired an architect. And that was not really done that often back in the middle to late 60s. And I was fascinated by the work he did, the process he went through, the drawings. And, of course, back in those days, everything was done by hand, freehand, and pencils and rulers. And I loved all the tools. Loved the scales and the triangles and the straight edges and all of the things that went with it. It just fascinated me.
And that was it. And so that was like the turning point in your life. So, but how come you didn't become an architect?
Well, I started to, believe it or not. I actually went to Iowa State and enrolled in architecture. And at the time, in the early 70s, architecture was under the College of Engineering. Hmm. And while I loved the architecture and the design part of it, there was also a huge element of engineering that went with that. And we spent so much time in doing construction documents and technical drawing and quite honestly, just a lot of analysis of the engineering part of a building. And I found I didn't really like that. I got through my first year and a half of architecture, and my roommate was actually in the interior design school, which was at that time in the Home Ec College. And I scoffed at being in the Home Ec College. I didn't want to have any part of food and nutrition or any of the dietetics or any of that stuff. But ultimately, I did decide to change my major and enrolled in the interior design program and fell in love with every bit of it. I loved the decorative nature of it. I loved the expression. I loved the interpretation. My last year, we actually opened up the College of Design, and both disciplines then became part of the College of Design, which is now where both fields reside at Iowa State, and it's a very strong program.
Great. Wow, what an interesting story. Meanwhile, you have your father, who's the business person. I'm sure there was some influence there, so you had the artistic side and the business side.
Yes, exactly. In fact, I spent most of my summers in high school and college working for my dad at his bank. I learned how to be a teller. I learned how to deal with deposits, and I actually was his secretary for a summer, and he did teach me a great deal about banking and finance and that side of it. So while I knew really fast I didn't want to do that, I do know that that helped me a great deal in my future.
Yeah. So how did you become an interior designer, a professional one? What did you do after college?
Well, after college, the man I was dating and ultimately married, he also went to Iowa State, and his name is Mark, and he enrolled in optometry school in Chicago. So I followed him to Chicago, and I fortunately got a job at a pretty large commercial interior design firm right across the street from the Merchandise Mart, which is the mecca of interior design in the Midwest. And had wonderful mentors there. One of my favorite designers was an older woman. Her name was Magda Rebitzer. And she was a Holocaust survivor, a concentration camp survivor. She was the only one from her family that survived. She was a twin. And I remember, and coming from a small town in Iowa, I had never had any exposure really to anything like this. And I remember the first time I saw the tattoo on her arm, that was the number, her number from the concentration camp. She was the most beautiful, sophisticated, wonderful woman, and an incredibly gracious. She really held no ill will toward anyone, just looked at things pretty matter-of-factly, which I thought was pretty remarkable. But anyway, she took me under her wing, and she taught me pretty much everything about working in a business. Before that, going to school and learning the principles of design and all of the rules and all of that is one thing, but then to actually put it into practice is you quickly figure out is really not reality. And I think with the way I learned design, the projects we worked on were phenomenal, but we had no rules, we had no budget, we had no client. We just got to do whatever we wanted to, and our client was basically our instructor who evaluated what we did. And the real world was an adjustment because all of a sudden we had to face the fact that these clients wouldn't necessarily pay what we were dreaming up. And anyway, so she took me on calls and taught me the ropes and was just a wonderful mentor for me in those early years when I really learned how much I didn't know about the business. And I had a wonderful boss, was very patient with me. And we got to do some pretty remarkable projects. I worked on several commercial client projects in the Sears Tower, which it was called at that time. And we worked on some high-end hotel projects in the Loop and in the downtown Chicago area. So it was a great experience for me starting out.
Well, what kind of things were you aware of? It's like you're aware of the audience, but it's a corporate audience. It's like for many people passing through. It's not for an individual client so much. It's more for a larger mass audience. What kind of things were you made aware of?
Well, I think there's several audiences, believe it or not. I mean, there's actually the client who's trying to sell a product, and so you're trying to help them get their message out there. There are the people that work for the client. So they have a staff. They have people that have to be productive. They have to be efficient. They have to do their job and do it well. And then there's the client's clients, the people that are, in many cases, coming into the space, using the space, getting first impressions of the space, looking for professionalism and success. Most people want to hire somebody who's who's got a track record, but also looks like they have a track record. So
in dress or in grooming?
I would say in their space. I mean, people are people. You talk about first impressions of people, but then there's also first impressions of a space you walk into. Ooh. Most people pay attention to their surroundings and is it lit well? Is it clean? But is it also attractive? Does it feel comfortable or does it feel disorganized? Is it a mess? All of those things play into that overall impression as a person walks into this space. So,
what is your office like?
Well, that's a really good question. It's a great space to work in. We have a building. Darla, my business partner, and I bought a building in downtown Davenport. It's over 100 years old. It's right on 2nd Street. And it's actually where the Barrel House restaurant is. And we bought that building 16 years ago and renovated it. And our offices are up on the 3rd floor. We have a little bit of a view of the river, which is wonderful. But we have exposed brick walls and exposed floor joists and ceiling rafters and things like that. So we took it back to kind of the original structure. But it's really... my office, for example, I have a lot of just personal things. I have lots of photographs that I take. I take pictures of crazy things like architectural elements and doors and, funny things like that. And I just have like a whole series of European doors on my tack board. And I love to have different motivational messages. And don't ask me to give you any because I can't remember any right now. But I just have lots of little things that inspire me. It's really... a pleasant place to work, great lighting. We've got fabrics and furniture and all kinds of things. We have a huge library that we draw from to put together our projects.
Almost like your balls of yarn or your tubes of paint.
Exactly.
Are the fabrics.
Our palette.
Palette, exactly right. Many years ago, there was a designer of the plays, the background and the set and the stage here at Augustana, and she said she was having trouble. I think it was Ibsen's The Birdhouse, and she was having trouble coming up with something, and it came down on a moment of desperation. She had a square inch of a yellow ochre goldy fabric, and from that little square inch, the costumes and the set and the lighting and everything came out of that. That was her one point of inspiration. Does that kind of thing happen to you?
It does every once in a while, but I think for us, especially with commercial design, we're so much more focused on listening to what our customers want, what our clients are looking for. And in many cases, it starts out with more of a need for improvement in how they work. So we're taking that and we're looking at how they might relate to other staff. How does their workflow from one person to the next or from one client to the next, and making sure that their space allows them to either communicate or in some cases maybe they need privacy. It's all of those kinds of things. So we start out in most cases with a floor plan. We're drawing a plan and we're arranging the people in the space, or we might be in the case where it's maybe not an office, it's more of a public space, like a library. We just are in the process of finishing up the Bettendorf Library renovation. And in that case, we're paying attention to what the librarians need, but also what the visitors need, what the people visiting the library
would like. Nice little enclosed area for the children with the doorway walking through. You are now walking into the children's room.
Yeah, with a big kid's sculpture on the front.
Yeah.
In this last phase, we just designed a beautiful fireplace, stone fireplace wall for their reading area, so that the people that visit can come and sit comfortably in a more lounge feeling area and enjoy the fireplace and relax.
Gosh, you're everywhere. How do you know what to do? It can't be all just the client saying something, because maybe they don't know what they want to do.
Well, many times they don't, and in fact, we make it our point to help them understand what it is they want to do. In fact, I have an example of, I had a client once that we just didn't quite communicate well together. We just seemed like I just wasn't getting it. And I kept bringing things to him and he kept saying, that's just not it. And he kept telling me he wanted Art Deco. And I was bringing him everything I could possibly imagine that related to Art Deco in some way, shape, or form. Well, finally, he showed me a picture of what he thought Art Deco was. It wasn't Art Deco, it was Queen Anne, which was not even close to what I was going for. So I learned from that experience that I needed to probably make sure that we're on the same page from day one with what we're talking about. And in fact, for a long time, and when I'm working with some of my other designers, I'll kind of remind them, well, is it really Queen Anne? And it's just sort of a figure of speech for them to remember that they need to make sure they're on the same page from the start.
Yeah. What is art history? Yeah. To learn that. How interesting. We're speaking with Dana Wilkinson. She's a commercial interior designer. Is there a hierarchy between, say, private interior designers and commercial interior designers?
You know, I wouldn't say it's a hierarchy. I would say it's more a different direction. In many cases, the products are different. And going back to your question about the way we figure out what the client is really wanting, we have lots of manufacturers of products that are constantly developing new things, new furniture, new workstations, new task chairs with technology. They're even coming up with new ways to support computer monitors, all those kinds of things. And we have trade shows. We actually go to a show every year in Chicago called NeoCon, and that's when all these vendors come and display their newest, latest, greatest inventions, and we learn a lot from that. And they're all incredibly creative, and they also introduce new materials. The big thing now is surface materials, as we call them, different types of glass, different types of resin materials that are actually pieces of plastic, but they're forming them into things that can be used for dividers or mounted on the wall as signage, or just all kinds of different ways of using these materials. And in fact, we're using some at the library in Bettendorf. We're actually, there's a company down in Muscatine that manufactures these for us, and they're resin panels, and they shape them into waves, and they're suspended from the ceiling by cables, and they're translucent, so light shines through them, and they're multicolored. We have one that's blue and green and yellow, and it adds a really beautiful element to the ceiling, adds texture and form and flow, so it's really fun to be able to learn out about all these other materials. But back to your question about residential versus commercial, there are some companies that do both and do them very, very well. We have chosen not to. We do a tiny bit of residential, mostly for clients that we've gotten to know and have worked on their commercial project. But we don't do it on a regular basis. We certainly don't market ourselves that way because, again, it's different materials. Bedroom furniture is way different than office furniture. And it's different product lines, and it's a lot to learn just with what we do right now, so we've chosen not to venture into that avenue.
I was wondering if it was like passenger and freight, you know, if there was, you're a commercial,
no.
Or you're a passenger.
Steerage, no.
It's nothing like that.
No, not
it's
at
just
all.
A different, it's like wheel throwers and hand builders and pottery.
Exactly.
It's just a different world. Very, very interesting. Well, speaking with Dana Wilkinson, she's an interior designer. She's been working with Paragon Commercial Interiors for over 31 years with her business partner, Darla Evans, right down along the river. Very interesting stuff, another art form. Let's take a short break right now, and we'll be right back after this gallery guide.
On exhibit around the WVIK listening area at the Augustana College Art Museum through October 25th, A Different Way of Seeing, Swedish Art from the Charters Collection. Hours are noon to 4, Tuesday through Saturday. In the Art Space Gallery in Building 4 on the Blackhawk College campus in Moline through September 19th, paintings by David Murray. Hours are 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday. In the Galvin Fine Arts Center on the St. Ambrose University campus in Davenport in the Morrissey Gallery, through September 28th, Mixed Media Works by Heather Baker. Hours are 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday. In the Kanich Gallery, from September 10th through October 24th, Bookworks by Brian Borkert and Quilts by Eric Wolfmeyer. Hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Saturday. at the Figge Art Museum on West 2nd Street in Davenport through September 14th from pencil to printed page, Arthur Geisert's Thunderstorm. Through October 26th, Living Proof, works by cancer survivors and patients. Through November 2nd, Two Americans in Paris, Stuart Davis and Grant Wood. Through January 25th, Turned Wood. And through April 30th, A Legacy for Iowa. Hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Thursday. At Midcoast at Center Station on River Drive in Moline through September 30th, drawings by Ann Kaufman and mixed media works by Isaias Mejia. Hours are 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday, 9 to 5 Sunday. At Midcoast Gallery West on 2nd Avenue in Rock Island through the end of October, acrylics by Dan Johnson and jewelry by Monica Shans. Hours are 11:30 to 5:30 Wednesday through Saturday. At the Bucktown Center for the Arts on East 2nd Street in Davenport through the end of October, photography by Richard Kluel and Matthew Terry. Hours are Wednesday through Saturday from 11 to 6. At the Quad City Arts Gallery on 2nd Avenue in Rock Island through October 24th, Good Enough to Eat, an art buffet. Hours are Tuesday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturdays from 11 to 5. At Quad City Arts at the airport in the Moline International Airport through October 30th, mixed media works by Kimberly Rocha, collages by Amber Williams, and stoneware by Dale DeBokey. And that's a look at current exhibits around the WVIK listening area.
Back on Art Talks, Dana Wilkinson is with us. Dana is an interior designer. She's designed the Figge, the Bettendorf Library, the inside of WVIK, how interesting, and Paragon Commercial Interiors for over 30 years. Dana, you are obviously have a trained eye, and you have this wonderful artist and one foot in the art world and one foot in the entrepreneurial world, where you have the business and art. So you have to think clearly. You have to translate, in a sense, a vision of color and light and space and form and texture and all of that into a world of business, into a world of people who are not maybe familiar with that, but are looking for some effect, who are looking for a presentation, who are looking for an announcement of their status, of their security, of their level of intelligence, of their level of success. And how interesting, because you have to translate, in a sense, their feelings into form.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that?
That's a really good question. I would say that by listening, number one, mm. I think that, you know, probably to me, the one quality that I really, in fact, look for when I'm hiring somebody, especially a designer, is curiosity. I think it's incredibly important that one be curious and be interested in learning about other things. Mm. And what I've found is that I do have that sort of insatiable curiosity. And when I meet a new client that is maybe doing some sort of business that I don't know anything about, like, for example, when we met at the Trimble facility, I had never done a funeral home before. Mm-hmm. And when I met with Eric and Reed and their family and talked to them about the funeral home, I was pretty upfront, and I said, I've been to many funerals, but I've never been involved in interior design of a funeral home. And fortunately, they embraced that because they really wanted it to look less funeral home-like and more welcoming and accomplishing many of the other things that we talked about earlier.
It looks like a kind of a recreational room for a high-level business.
Right, more of a community center kind of a thing. And that's really, I think, their goal was to, you know, do something that could be multi-use and really function in more ways than just to service as a memorial service. And I think we accomplished that. But what I learned from that was what I didn't know about funeral home and the whole entire funeral home business and how it's changing in time and people aren't having funerals the way they used to. So the whole point of that is that by learning about and asking a lot of questions about my clients' business and how they do it and what they do, I've gained so much and learned so much about other business entities and how they operate. We do a lot of banks, and fortunately, I had the experience from being in banking as a young adult, and I translated that into at least being able to ask some sort of intelligent questions. But sometimes it's really just the basic questions. What do you do? How do you do it? What's important? It's really some of the questions you're asking me, and those are the questions I ask people to get a basis, to get a baseline of how to interpret that into something. And then really it's a process of lots of pencil to paper to really just get down to the mechanics of doing the design work. And I know you asked earlier about you mentioned something about inspiration, and it can be anything from something that I've seen in an article or in a magazine to passing down the street and seeing a cable attached to a sign and figuring out, well, that might work for this particular application of what we're doing with some installation. So it can be anything. Nature is a huge inspiration, certainly, and color that exists in nature, sunsets and mountainsides and all of those kinds of things. And, you know, I tend to not want to be a trendy kind of a designer. And some people sometimes ask me, well, what's your style? And my answer always is, I don't have a style. I don't want to have a style because I don't think my clients are hiring me for my style. I want to interpret their style. They're the ones that have to exist in the space, and I want them to be comfortable in that space. And that's really been Paragon's way of moving through client relationships, is to make sure that the space is comfortable for them and not necessarily a statement of how we do something. Although, fortunately, I think we've been we've really been successful in the clients and the projects that we've accomplished. And we've got people that constantly come up to us and say, well, you must have done that because it looks so good. And we're, of course, obviously very proud of that.
Nice. You're almost like a portrait artist or a filmmaker who doesn't get in the way of the film, who doesn't call attention to the camera work.
Exactly. Exactly.
How interesting. So you're kind of a self-effacing interior designer, but you're known by the level, the quality of the work.
Exactly. That is certainly our goal. It is certainly our goal. And in fact, oftentimes we'll have clients that will say, well, I want my space to look just like, you know, this one you just finished, and we won't do that. We will never do that. I'm constantly saying to people, you know, you hired me to do something for you, and I'm not going to do what I just finished doing for somebody else. You would not want to see your work that you paid for in somebody else's space.
Are you interpreting the client to themselves? Are you holding a mirror up to them?
I don't know if I'd actually think of it that way, but I think what I'm trying to do is that. I think I'm trying to read what it is that they're trying to say and interpret it. And sometimes, many times, what they're saying isn't really what they mean. You know, they're trying to convey an idea, but don't have the words, don't have the vision or the visual to really express what it is. They may say things like, well, I want it to feel homey. Well, what's homey to you is different than what's homey to somebody else. So we have to really digest that and really figure out what homey is. And so that involves more questions and more definition of
psychology.
Homey.
Yeah, oh, exactly. Interesting, yeah. There was a very interesting film on Frank Gehry, the great architect. Mm-hmm. And this guy was saying, you know, he come in and he doesn't ask you questions like, do you want round windows or square windows? He says he just kind of smells you. He just kind of takes it and he goes off and he comes back with something just spectacular. And if he doesn't like it, he'll rip it apart and do it again. Mm-hmm. Do you edit yourself? Do you rewrite yourself a lot?
I wouldn't say a lot. I think that I probably should more. I think that I need to. My feeling is that I'm always trying to make sure that I'm listening to what my client wants and responding to that. And sometimes I will get pretty adamant about that's not the right solution. And that works sometimes and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes I need to step back and rethink that and really let go of whatever it was that was really important to me, because I have to remember it's not my space. It's their space.
Huh. But you're making the space.
I am.
And you're putting your name on it someplace,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah. And I do make it pretty clear that I won't put my name on something that I hate. So somehow we have to reach a compromise.
Yeah. I'm remembering a Doris Day, Rock Hudson movie many years ago, where it was called Party Line, and she was an interior designer, and she designed his place for him. Mm-hmm. Interesting, very interesting. You are like a portrait artist. You are interpreting the person according to your level. You're not intruding your own sensibilities. Kind of
to a
are
certain level, right?
To a certain level, mm-hmm. You are, and you're really. Exhibiting the client you're lighting them in a perfect way. What an interesting occupation it is. And then you've got that business side of it too. So mm-hmm. you obviously have to order and buy and sell and trade and do all of that too.
Exactly. And fortunately, I have great people that do that. One of the things that my dad did teach me is hire really smart people to do stuff that you don't do well. And I've been really lucky to have that. And I do find the business side of it interesting and challenging, and it exercises that other side of my brain. And I think that, you know, with age and maturity, after doing this for 30 years, you kind of figure it out. And fortunately, I've kind of grown up with computers. When we first started the business, we had a typewriter. And all our drawings were done with pencils and straight edges and just those same tools that I was in love with when I was a little girl. And now all of our drawings are done on the computer, AutoCAD systems, and there's new technology coming out all the time that makes our lives so much easier when it comes to doing drawings and making changes. And of course, all of our proposals and all of our invoices and all the billing and accounting and all of that is done on the computer. And we keep track of each other on our phones, and it's just a whole different world than it was 30 years ago.
Mm. And you're comfortable with that?
Oh, very.
You like technology?
I love technology. I do.
No problem for you.
No. Oh, I do think, though, that there is an element of technology that stymies creativity.
How so?
Well, when I watch my younger designers especially, and they're wonderful, they're fantastic, but they look at everything on a little computer monitor, and we have the biggest monitors we can put in our space. But I think that is not the best way to challenge the creative mind as much as just working with materials, to actually work with physical elements. And certainly we are fortunate because we can walk into our library and you can't really pick out materials on a computer. You have to really have the actual mm-hmm. samples. So we can
escape. So the virtual and the real.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. Speaking with Dana Wilkinson. Dana, you were involved with the Vicky.
Yes, I was.
Talk about that. What a fascinating journey that was. I remember they did a study up on the hill, and it would cost $6 million to refurnish the museum. And golly, for $6 million, you can do something else.
Yeah, well, it actually ended up being quite the project. And I actually was not involved in the design of it, but I was really involved in the selection process and the fundraising part of it. I happened to be on the Friends of the Davenport Museum of Art at the time that this process was going through. And at the same time, there was a move to present a proposal to the state of Iowa for the Vision Iowa grants, if you recall. And so the two sort of came together at the same time, and it was decided that we should put the building down downtown on Second Street. And through that process, I was asked to become the executive director of the Museum Foundation, the Davenport Museum of Art Foundation, which was the precursor to the Figge Art Museum. And part of my role was that I had the opportunity to go on the architectural search team. And we hired a consultant. His name was Bill Lacey, who was a fascinating man who had worked with world-renowned architects, knew everybody that had done museums. And at the time we were doing this project, museums were a huge deal in the world. People were building museums, art museums, and natural history museums all over the place. It was a really popular part of architecture at the time. And so everybody was interested in our project. And through the connections that Bill had, we sent out a request for proposals to these phenomenal architects. It was just mind-blowing to me to have this chance to have these people consider designing a building in the Quad Cities. And we ended up with 50 proposals.
Golly.
From people like Richard Meyer and Frank Gehry and, of course, David Chipperfield and many others. And we ended up through the whole process, and we had a wonderful team of people. Diane Finney was sort of the head of our group and really led us through the process, and she did a fantastic job. We shortlisted it to five architects, and they were Guathamy and Siegel, who have done phenomenal projects all over the world. One you may know is the Levitt Center in Iowa City, part of the University of Iowa. Raphael Vignoli, who is an architect out of New York City, has done work all over the world. And, of course, David Chipperfield and a Finnish team, Markku and Miku, and they had done some phenomenal museum work in Finland and in the Scandinavian area, and Richard Meyer. And, of course, Richard Meyer had just at that time finished the project in Los Angeles, the Guggenheim in Los Angeles. And so we then, with that short list, went to many of these architects' projects and got tours and had the chance to visit and meet these architects. And we went to Finland. We went to Helsinki. We went to London, of course, to see David's work. We got to go to California, and met every single one of those architects. I actually got to sit next to Richard Meyer and had dinner with him several times.
Golly,
it was just fascinating. It was really a fantastic experience. And then going through the process of the selection was really probably one of the most interesting things I've ever experienced.
Wow, fascinating. Speaking with Dana Wilkinson, talking about her experiences with setting up the Figge. She's a interior designer with Paragon Commercial Interiors. Let's take another break right now, and we'll be right back after this gallery guide.
On exhibit around the WVIK listening area at the Geneseo Art League Gallery on South State Street in Geneseo, Wood Art Show, works by Jim Dayton, Bob Benson, Carl Smith, and Warren Hadley. Hours are 11 to 5 Wednesday through Saturday. At the Renee Gray Gallery on South Cody Road in the Clare through September 28th, A Personal Perspective, Finding Beauty in the Unexpected, works by Lee Kimball and other artists. Hours are 11 to 5 every day except Sunday. At Roz Talks on 3rd Avenue in Rock Island, on continuing exhibit, Object Permanence, works by 20 local artists. Hours are 11 to 1 a.m. Tuesday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. on Sunday. at the Galesburg Civic Arts Center at 114 East Main Street in Galesburg. Through September 16th, Galesburg High School art student honorees. From September 12th through October 18th, works by Joyce and Jeffrey Gellick. Hours are Tuesday through Friday from 10:30 to 4:30, Saturday from 10:30 to 3. At the Buchanan Center for the Arts on the Square in Monmouth through October 25th, the Security Savings Bank Photo Competition. Hours are 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, Saturdays from 10 to 2. At the Muscatine Art Center at 1314 Mulberry Avenue in Muscatine through January 25th, Railroads of Muscatine County. Hours are Tuesday through Friday from 10 to 5, Thursday evening 7 to 9, Saturdays and Sundays from 1 to 5. At the Dubuque Museum of Art at 701 Locust Street in Dubuque through October 19th, Modern Landscapes, paintings by Grant William Tye. Through November 30th, Homage to the Tall Grass Prairie, watercolors by George Olson. The Grant Wood Gallery on continuing exhibit. Hours are Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 10 to 5, Thursdays until 7 p.m., Saturdays and Sundays from 1 to 4. At the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art at 410 3rd Avenue in Cedar Rapids, through November 2nd, Marvin Cohn, On My Mind, The Ceramics of Dean Schwartz. On continuing exhibit, Art in Roman Life, Grant Wood in Focus, and Maurizio Lozanski, Master Printmaker. Hours are Tuesday through Saturday from 10 to 4, Thursdays 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., Sundays noon to 4. And that's a look at current exhibits around the WVIK listening area.
On Art Talks, Dana Wilkinson is with us. She's an interior designer, Paragon Commercial Interiors, also worked with the Figge, the Bettendorf Library, and our own station here, among many, many others. This program and many previous programs going back over 2 years are available at our website, wvik.org. Click on the schedule button at the top of the page, scroll down to Art Talks, click that, and they will appear by date, a name of the artist, and a brief description of what they do, and we'll probably call you a commercial interior designer.
Perfect.
Okay. Artist entrepreneur, I think, also would be true. Well, let's continue with the Figge. This is fascinating. I know you're on the board of the Figge. You're on the big board of the Figge, but this is the making of the Figge. And when we last left off, you had shortlisted the architects from 50 down to 5.
Right.
You're having dinner with
Richard Meyer.
Richard Meyer,
yes.
And you're texting on your phone. I'm having.
If I had a phone, I would have been doing that. But yes, it was surreal to be literally sitting next to him, and of course I'm more than starstruck, and I'm thinking, what am I going to say to this world famous architect? And he really was wonderful. We talked about gardening. We talked about just regular things, and he was just delightful. And as it stood, we ultimately did not select Richard Meyer. We selected David Chipperfield.
Why?
We had quite a lot of conversation about it, and some may recall that the proposals that were submitted, many had models and obviously some designs associated with those, and we looked very carefully at those, and we actually decided that we could kind of divide our group into sort of the architects that had sort of made it in their career and those that were up and coming.
Hmm.
And we found it a little more interesting to focus on the architects that were up and coming. And with some advice really from from our consultant, Bill Lacey, he felt very strongly that David Chipperfield and some of the other younger architects were probably really just on the rising star. So, and we absolutely loved what David proposed and his sensitivity to the site and his urban interpretation. We really appreciated his look at how the Figge would, at the time, of course, it didn't have the name, but how that museum would look in a downtown setting. And I think he was incredibly successful. And we actually went through a couple of reiterations of the project. It started out that it was going to be on 2nd Street, and then we pushed it back so it was closer to the river. I think that was a great decision. I think it really takes command of that block beautifully. One of the designs that David had done initially ended up actually being put in the Venice Biennale, which is sort of the world's fair of architecture and art. And to have that selected to be in Venice was just really a wonderful opportunity. And I had the chance to go to Venice and be a part of that representation. David had our model, and he talked all about the Figge, and the mayor of Venice was there, and it was just a really phenomenal chance to be a part of that.
Plus, you're in Venice.
In Venice, exactly. It was a quick trip, but it was really, really wonderful. And, uh-huh. and you know, so the Figge was really an international museum. It was interested, many, many people were interested in taking a look at what we were doing. You know, it took a while to get it built, obviously, because it was so complicated. We had to deal with floodplain and parking and all kinds of things. But no, it's been open now 10 years. We're getting ready to celebrate the 10th anniversary, and we're hoping to bring back some of the people that were involved originally and do a really special celebration to kick off the next decade.
That'd be great. You know, I met him just briefly twice. He said that he had been raised on a sheep farm in Wales. Growing up, he had wanted to become a veterinarian, but instead he made this jump into these severe geometric architectural forms. And yet when I met him, he was very sheep-like. He had a goat hair tie and velour, you know, coat and velvety pants and velvety shoes, and he had all these textural qualities to him, which he hadn't lost. But this perhaps was the other side of his brain.
It could have been. I did not actually even know about the sheep farm story, but David's a very, very nice person. He was very approachable. We met his family. We met his wife. His wife is lovely. His children, he has four kids, very devoted dad. We haven't seen him in a while, but hopefully he'll come back.
There's no longing on your part of the road not taken to become an architect. I mean, you could have hired somebody to do all these engineering mathematical problems for you.
You know, had I known it then, you know, when you're a college student, you really don't think that way. You don't think that clearly. And I get a chance to be a part of architecture. I work with lots of great architects, and they can do that part. I'll take care of the inside, and I'm very happy doing that. Uh-huh. And it's really, for me, the interior is. Well, and of course, this is me speaking, but I find it more interesting because there's so many elements. You have lighting, you have, you know, finishes, you have floors, walls, you have furniture, you have artwork, you have so many elements to deal with, and pulling it all together. It's really, it's quite a challenge to bring all those details into concert.
Different kind of space. You're still working with space, but you're working with real three-dimensional space.
And, exactly.
And how the body feels moving through it.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about feng shui? Feng shui?
Well, I am not a student of feng. It's actually pronounced feng shui.
Feng shui.
And I think that there are some elements that you sort of naturally know. And I know there's things about energy leaving a room and entering and coming out of a room. And honestly, I don't know a lot about it, but it's a fascinating study, and there are some people that very, very much believe strongly in the energy and how it works.
In the history of interior design, it basically follows, in a sense, the history of art.
Yes.
Going through and all the different periods, and from the Rococo and the Baroque, and you know, the mm-hmm. Pompeii and Roman, and on up to present. Is there any kind of movement in interior design now? I look at magazines, or I look mm-hmm. at architecture magazines, and everything is real severe and almost brutally clean, and it just seems so sterile and harsh. You know, I want to have some sort of something to look at. You know, it's like there's like a world for people who want to rest, or who don't want to be bothered by anything.
Well, I think that's probably more the norm. I think the things that you see in magazines, maybe they're taking things to an extreme. You know, certainly you don't see much of that around here. I think that we find that people want to have spaces that are more personalized. There is sort of a new wave in work spaces that is really kind of the direction is depersonalizing workspace, because we're being pushed to get rid of clutter and get rid of paper, and many developments are looking at the cost of space and how expensive it is to actually rent a floor of a building or whatever the square footage might be, and by reducing the amount of space down to its very essential elements, a computer, in many cases not even a phone, because most people can communicate through their computer, and having very little on their desk to distract them, their work is that, and in some cases they don't even have their own personal desk. They may move from one desk to another, and they, in sometimes bigger companies, you'll just make a trip to the reception desk in the morning, and you'll find out what your assigned desk is for the day, and you take your little movable file cabinet with you, and that's where you are for the day. So there's that extreme. We've seen some of it, and actually younger people tend to really like it, because they're not as focused on work being where they live as much as they are just, this is work, and they're separating the idea of work and life. So it's an interesting approach. But we've also found that in other areas of design, not so much the workplace, but higher ed, we're doing a lot of higher education. We've done a lot of work for Augustana College, just finished their student Center for Student Life building, which is the big addition onto the library. Those kinds of spaces we're really making much more comfortable and less institutional. We're introducing lots more color in the walls and different textures and the floors and fabrics on the furniture and art. Art is becoming more important in cases like this, because they do want to have that escape or that way to have some visual interest on the walls. Hmm. In fact, I'm working with Trinity Hospital right now. They're doing a new project, their emergency and heart center project, and they actually are paying a great deal of attention to the art, and there's a whole study on art and how it can benefit the healing process, and what is the appropriate kind of image for that to happen. And mm-hmm. and so they're paying a lot of attention to that.
Interesting. Iowa City, the University of, they have a tremendous art collection.
Yes, they do.
From floor to ceiling, I mean, from and every part of the building. And I think it does play a great part. It's interesting going through the hallways, because you'll see a work, it's like, they could maybe retire that piece, or they could mm-hmm. bring something else up. And then I'll watch the people walking by to see if they look at it. And I think everyone is so immersed in their physical ailments and problems that it becomes a background. But I think mm-hmm. I think it does have an effect. It warms the building up. Like in the interior of the Figge, where you walk into the main room, mm-hmm. the drapes are hung sometimes, and I think it softens that space.
Right.
It's a very interesting thing that you do, because you describe, you comfort, you cushion humanity You know, you give them a place to live in, to work in, and it's subtle, and it's very strong. You know, the places that you go, I think it's a very marvelous, noble profession.
Well, thank you. It's great fun. I love every minute of it.
Yeah,
and it's never boring.
Never.
Never boring. We're always doing something new and different. There's always a new challenge. And, you know, just about the time I finish up a project and think, okay, I'm relieved that one's now finished, there's another one on the horizon that I'm just getting started.
Nice. What a nice thing to do.
Yeah.
How do you ever turn it off?
Never. My husband laughs at me because I'll be in a restaurant and I'll be tipping the chairs over, looking to see what kind of chair it is. I'll be looking at the wall covering, I'll be looking at the lighting. I'm always marveling at somebody else's work and how did they come up with that? And what a great idea is that? Or that's the ugliest fabric I've ever seen. It just never turns off.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. You're spoken like a true artist because you're always curious and you're always interested and you have this wide product knowledge and you've been gathering ideas for a long time.
Yeah.
And then you put it together through some mysterious process.
I don't think of it as mysterious. I think of it as sort of methodical because I think there's just one step after another and things tend to flow. They tend to really just sort of start to come together.
That's because you're at a very high level.
And I think it's also that artist part. I've actually did take many classes and painted and I do still love to do that. But I don't know how to turn it off. I can't stop. I'm always looking to tweak it a bit.
Poets say the same thing. They have a poetic sensibility, and it's always on. And, you know, you can't really get rid of it. And musicians are always listening all the time. Oh, listen to the rhythm of that key warning. You left your key in the car, and then it's going to the rhythm of something on the radio. And they're just always attuned to those kind of things. Mm. Well, Dana, we've reached the end of our hour. It's gone by very fast. Very
yes.
Nice. What advice do you, as an experienced interior designer, or artist, however you want to address it, what advice do you have for young artists?
Well, I would certainly tell them to find mentors. Mentors are a huge help. I really truly believe that. I don't know that I would have done what I had done without the people that have guided me through the process. I would also just ask lots of questions and really accept the fact that you're never going to know everything, and you really don't want to. It's always so much fun to learn something new.
Very nice. Very nice. And ParagonCommercialInteriors.com?
Yes.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. Dana.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nice, nice hour. That's it for us today on Art Talks. Many thanks to our guests. Many thanks to our audio engineer, that maestro of sound, Dave Garner. As always, I'm Bruce Carter. Until next week, have a great night and a fine tomorrow. See you soon, Laura.
Support for Art Talks comes from the Blue Cat Brew Pub, located in the district of Rock Island, serving food and handcrafted ales and lagers. And from the Bucktown Center for the Arts at 225 East 2nd Street in downtown Davenport, with 16 independent studios and galleries offering original fine art and gift ideas in one location. Information is at bucktownarts.com.